Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes, and Maysoon Waswas, who you'll hear in just a minute when we get to our fantastic interview. I just wanted to remind listeners that we are on our every other week summertime schedule, and we will be resuming our weekly schedule at the end of summer. I have a feeling that people have been confused, thinking, weren't they weekly? Did I just imagine that? Well, you didn't imagine it. We're on our summertime schedule, and we'll be back to normal before you know it. If you have any thoughts on this, you can give us a call or text at 419-351-6606. You can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast. Enjoy the show! Okay, we're out here in beautiful San Francisco, California, in our old stomping grounds of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, speaking to Nancy Lim, Assistant Curator of Painting and Sculpture here at SF MoMA. What's your general stance on bodily fluids and bodily remnants in art in general?
In general?
Is that something that draws you to a lot of work?
Yeah, I guess anything that's a little bit creepy is great, right? Oh. Especially because it freaks out a lot of museum workers because it can be such difficult material to handle, to handle or to preserve or take care of or make sure that it's sanitary. There's so many logistical, practical concerns when it comes to having that kind of material in the galleries and making sure that it's hygienic or safe or for visitors and doesn't attract pests. So all that stuff is, I like that side of museum work a lot and working with conservation registrar and other colleagues across departments here to make it happen. But I don't know, no one likes poop in the galleries, right? But all other things, I don't really mind. Unless it's dried dung.
Right.
And of course, it's not an uncommon material for artists to use, and we have some of that in our collection already.
Yeah, you can't be a big hitter in contemporary art if you haven't got a Chris Ufili painting, right?
Right. With some dung. Yeah, or a little David Hammond sculpture.
Yeah, there you go.
I like to keep like a good, a healthy distance, especially in live performance.
I think that's smart.
I'm a little queasy, but I'm all for it also.
A
lot of things have smells along with them, and that's a whole other level.
Because I respect the tradition, you know what I mean? I mean, vomit is hundreds of years of performance. Anyhow.
I want to ask about the Just Show, because that's sort of a part of the California galleries. And is that up right now, or did
it's up right now. It's up until, I think it's August.
Do you want to just say every month, and I'll just cut in the one that's right?
September.
You know, the reason why I'm getting confused about it is that I also worked on the V.S. Selman Show, which is currently traveling. And so I have all these closing dates and opening dates rattling in my brain. So right now, it's at the AGO Toronto, and that's what it is. So that show closes in early October. August 5th, and then it travels to the Met Broyer, and then it opens there September 23rd. And so I'm also trying to remember Sika date. So Sika opens in November, and so the Just Show must close right before that. So I think the closing date is October.
Can you talk about how you, like what your sort of curatorial focus was for the Just Show, like if you were focusing on, specific works or a larger retrospective? Or
I've wanted to do an all Just Show for a little while now because he's such a fascinating artist to me. And we have a really solid collection of Just works in the museum's collection. But we didn't have enough to fill all three galleries. So the California galleries are three galleries on the second floor. And so I was trying to figure out other creative ways to show all of those works, but have it be a full presentation. And so my colleague Zoe and I were batting around ideas, and we decided to insert other artists who have been in conversation with Jess, either directly in conversation. So, for example, friends of Jess, collaborators, or people who, in their minds, were in conversation with him. For example, inspired by him. One example of that would be Coulter Jacobson. Mm-hmm. So it became this full, or you know, saw Jess as a teacher, even if they never had the chance to meet him. So it became a broader intergenerational conversation among California artists who share Jess's romantic and mystical sensibility. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a shadow history of 20th century California art that Zill and I wanted to explore in the show.
Cool.
Yeah.
I love Jess's work.
Me too.
His work is incredible. And there's a humbleness and a modesty to the way that he approached art making, which I really appreciated, mm-hmm. especially in context of today and all the bombast mm-hmm. From a lot of artists today. So, for example, Jess, when he started doing a lot of his paintings, he thought of them as paint-by-number mm-hmm. paintings. So that's how he did it. He colored in segments by numbers as a way to teach himself how to paint. And so he approached that medium with such modesty and kind of methodical self-teaching. But, you know, I know that he didn't necessarily need to. And there would have been a lot of other artists who already had his skill level mm-hmm. who never would have approached it that way. Mm-hmm. And so I find that humbleness very moving.
I've heard about the puzzle pieces.
I love the puzzle pieces.
Have you heard of those?
No.
They're jigsaw puzzles that he kind of rearranged. I mean, I don't know how close they are to the intended image, but it adds like way more depth and interest to the image, which I was like, I love jigsaw puzzles. So I was like, oh my God, next jigsaw puzzle, I'm going to do a Jess style.
Yeah, well,
so
I think excited. There should be a jigsaw puzzle in general. You could have Jess, you have Felix Gonzalez Torres, you have all kinds of artists. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be really beautiful.
Are there any jigsaw puzzle pieces in the show?
No, we don't have any in the collection.
Okay.
We borrowed a couple of things, but...
Oh, it's all collection work, of course.
Yeah, but we have to keep it primarily collection-based. Mm-hmm. And no puzzle pieces, sadly.
So cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a show idea that mm-hmm. they wouldn't let you do?
That SF MoMA wouldn't let me do?
Yeah.
Well, yes, but the answer is a lot more complicated than yes. Mm-hmm. So it has to do in part with the spaces in the museum that are apportioned to each curatorial department. So we have the curatorial departments we have are painting, sculpture, media, arts, photography, contemporary, and architecture and design. So painting and sculpture, the spaces in the museum that are in our purview are fourth floor. Not always, but most of the time. For example, where the Rauschenberg show was, Via Selmans, et cetera, where the Warhol is now. And then the entire second floor where we show the permanent collection. And that's also where the California galleries are, although those aren't exactly part of the permanent collection galleries. We show permanent collection stuff in the California galleries. So it's kind of, for that reason, it's kind of limited in who can do shows and where. I always have tons of ideas, and it's just not possible to do them. So you find other outlets for that. And one example of that is the DeRosa show. I have a DeRosa show coming up that opens April of next year. So it's a Deborah Remington survey.
Oh, okay.
And it'll be on view at the same time as a Gene Connor survey that Amy Owen of DeRosa is organizing. Mm-hmm. So those will be in the same building. It's the second building that's further set back on the property. And then I think in the other building, there'll be a Davina Semo installation, as well as another artist whose name I'm forgetting right now. Wow. But yeah, it'll be great. Exciting. I know. It's really exciting. Because I kept bugging Gary about doing a Deborah Remington show here, and it just wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. And then when I asked him if it was fine for me to do a Deborah Remington show at the DeRosa, he said yes. And
that's great.
Yeah, it is great. I think it was a way for... Now I'm not bugging him anymore about doing it here.
Well, it's just nice to know that you also aren't, like, you know, 100% beholden to this space, right? That you can take your ideas outside of here and it actually benefits everyone.
Yeah.
What happens then? Like, are there pieces from SF MoMA that you're getting over there?
Yeah. So we have, I think, 5 or 6 Deborah Remington works, but I'm only going to ask to borrow 3.
How do you resolve those, like, when they're... Everyone's kind of like trying to eke out space in the museum. Is there a physical combat?
A rumble.
Do you guys see who can get through a jigsaw puzzle fastest? You did earlier mention Sika.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
so excited about
me too.
Such an incredible group of artists. Mm-hmm. We're everyone was like, what? That's amazing. No, seriously, it feels like a really invigorating. I mean, whatever. Every secret show has been really awesome, but I'm excited about this one also.
Will you list them off for the listeners that have forgotten?
All 16? Okay. I have to look up.
Wait, there's 16?
Well, finalists.
Oh,
did you mean the Ordies?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the Ordies are Sahar Khoury, Kenyatta AC Hinkle, and Marlon Mullen. 16 would be amazing. All throughout the museum.
I was like, wait, do I know something I'm not supposed to know yet? Have they already been chosen? Can you help me understand how there's like a SICA member group that goes on the studio visits? Mm-hmm. I don't understand their relationship to the, are they part of the selection process? Are they part of like inviting people to give recommendation, like artist recommendation? I'm that's always something that's been super confusing to me, and I've never really known anyone well enough to ask them.
Yeah,
I just know that a damn shuttle bus full of people shows up because some of my studio mates were finalists, and like Mooney is my studio mate and got it last time, and I just know it was like just like a clown car.
I love the description, clown car.
I know, it's pretty amazing. I'm sure they will now love that too.
Well, so it's a donor group. Mm-hmm. So whoever the curators are for that year, they work really closely with development to they don't organize events. Or I should say development is the one organizing the events and most of the time conceptualizing what they will be. So doing all that programming and curators just tag along. So one of the things that one of the events among the long roster of events that people can participate in throughout the year are the SICA finalist studio visits. Mm-hmm. So all that SICA members are, the extent of their participation in choosing who will be the finalists is being able to nominate. So in the same way that we ask you or Bob Linder or other artworkers around the city for nominations, for artists, we also ask our SICA members for nominations. And that's it. But otherwise, the finalists are chosen, the finalists and the awardees are chosen by whoever the curators are that year.
And this year, it's always multiple curators. This year, there are three of you.
It's always two curators.
Always two.
Yeah. So usually one curator who's already done it with a new curator. But this year was different. Lindy and I have both, neither of us has ever done it before.
Mm-hmm. And it was just the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
And how was that as far as like narrowing down?
Well, we had more than 200.
Whoa!
Yeah. So there were 200 names originally that we had to whittle down to 16. And of course, we did it incrementally over a period of days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of exhausting because you get from 200 to 100. And of course, the smaller that you get, the smaller the numbers get, the more difficult that it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went from 200 to a quick cut to 100, and then probably to 80, 50, 40, 35, 34, 33.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of like driving criteria that you keep like in the front of your brain as you're looking? Like there's like, okay, we want to make sure we're pulling artists that are doing this kind of work or represent this or whatever.
Or that you have like a range of media or.
I think we were mindful of the range of media, especially since Lindy is a photography curator.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that we talked about quite a bit because there didn't end up being any dedicated photographers on the finalist list, and we both felt a little rueful about that, but that's just how it shook out. And of course, we didn't want it to be only painters, only sculptors, and so we tried to keep it as diverse as possible in terms of materials, mediums, et cetera, and this is what we ended up with.
So when it's being narrowed down to the 16, is it just you two whittling? The clown car crew, they're not necessarily...
It's two clown cars.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah.
They're not...
There's so many people on each bus.
Right.
Are they providing consultation, but do they get a say in who's cut and who makes it?
Mm-mm.
No. It's just you two.
Yeah.
Is the power overwhelming?
So a lot of them will voice... A lot of them will voice...
Oh, I'm sure. I could imagine.
Well, voice their opinions, and it's always great to hear them because I'm curious to know what everyone thinks about some aspects of someone's practice or something. But ultimately, it's the curator's decision. And it's after a lot of conversation. So for me and Lindy, we talked a lot. And sometimes we weren't able to meet during the day because of other meetings that we had or other things that we had to take care of, or our schedules were incompatible. So we would plan to take the BART home together because we both lived in the East Bay. So we would talk. Well, first of all, we would get on the BART, sit down, look around, make sure there was no one else that we recognized, and then start talking.
Yes, I love that.
So that's how we squeezed usually about 40 minutes of talking. And we did that several times.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's smart. Love that.
I love it. And
that's from my old job. Because with my old boss at MoMA, I would always do a walk and talk with her. Because she'd be scurrying from one meeting to another. And that's how I always grabbed an extra 5 minutes with her.
Like Aaron Sorkin Museum show.
Yeah.
And the donors, they're never like, if you get, they'll come out of the studio visit and be like, if you put this person in, you can kiss my money goodbye.
That's happened a couple of times.
What?
I'm just kidding. It's never happened.
I'm like, come on. That's just uncalled for behavior.
People. I totally could see them doing that.
But not for this.
Speaking of
Sika, so you have a really unique and somewhat jealous-making relationship with the world-famous art dog, Esther.
I can't believe it's more than one person has mentioned it. I had no Sahar threw Esther into my arms. I didn't anticipate it. And I also did not know that Esther is generally unfriendly to other people. And she was so happy in my arms. She was so cuddly. I love animals and I love dogs. And I'm always trying to resist posting images of animals on my Instagram feed because I feel like I already do it too much. But, you know, the one thing that I don't like is bony animals, bony dogs. But Esther is not. She's so cuddly.
She cuddled Esther.
Yeah.
I've never even gotten a pet
in on that dog. And I held her for a long time.
I know.
Because we were in the front yard, Sahar's front yard, when Sahar threw Esther into my arms. We were talking in the front yard for a really long time. And then eventually walked to the backyard as continuing to hold Esther. And so in total, it must have been 25 minutes or something.
See, isn't that amazing? Honestly, when you posted those photos, Jackie and I and multiple other people were like, what?
Jackie texted me.
Say, what? Is that Esther in Nancy's arms?
And then a few days later, someone came up to me in an opening and said something like, you are my new hero, or you're a celebrity. You actually held Esther. And that in combination with Jackie's text made me realize how rare it was that Esther lets anybody hold her.
I'm shocked.
We had, you know, Sahar was in a show at SFAC, and she brought Esther with her all the time. And Jackie, all of us were like, oh, if only we could pet Esther, cuddle with her, anything with her. It just wasn't going to happen.
Esther's the cutest dog. I told Sahar the other day, she looks like a drawing.
She is so interesting.
And she looks like a stuffed animal.
Yes. Kind of a little bit of a Muppet for me.
She looks like a Muppet.
Oh, my God.
Especially from certain angles when she smiles or something about how her mouth opens. And it's a perfect triangle from the side.
Such a cutie.
She's adorable. She's my dream dog. The way that she looks, she's my dream dog.
Cool.
Yeah.
Was this before or after Sahar got the Sika?
Yeah. We want to understand more.
It was after.
Okay.
So Esther knew.
Fair play.
Esther knew. Okay. She's like, I guess you're all right. You did good by my mom.
That is wild. That is wild to me.
Are you sweating a little bit?
I am. I'm a little overcome. Anyhow. Okay, what else you got?
So,
I thought that said Nostradamus, but it says Northwestern. You went to Northwestern.
Yeah.
But for your
I went to
doctorate.
Berkeley for undergrad.
Oh.
So Go I did Bears. Art History and English. I was pre-med my first 2 years.
Okay.
And then I was pre-med.
What?
I was being a good Korean daughter. And I thought I was really interested in it, but I was such a shitty student. So I got, and an uninterested student. So it was that was a lethal combination for my GPA.
Yeah.
So I think I must have gotten maybe got a C or a B minus in organic chemistry. I thought, this is bullshit. So I switched to what I always wanted to do, which was English.
Oh.
English literature.
Great.
That was always my first love. And then I had taken art history in my sophomore year because I was forced to, because it was a distribution requirement. And I remember when I was signing up for it, I thought, well, I should have at least a little bit of art history knowledge before I graduate from college, because isn't that what college degrees are about, having some sort of well-rounded whatever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I fell in love with it. So I decided to double major in art history and English. And one of the very first courses I took in artistry was with T.J. Clark. And then that's when I kind of never looked back.
I was going to ask who were the inspirations.
Yeah, although I was also very practical about it. And so I thought, if I'm going to major in art history and English, and, you know, at Berkeley, I don't know how it is now, but back in the early 2000s, there were two joke majors on campus, meaning not that they were actually jokes, but anytime someone brought up a joke major, these are the two majors that they would bring up. And one was philosophy and one was art history.
Really?
Yes. And that had gotten so embedded into my brain, I thought, if I'm doing an art history major, I'm not going to do it aimlessly. And so I thought about what actual career options there were. Because I didn't feel like, I mean, part of it had to do with inexperience, youthful inexperience, and also, and because of that, lack of imagination. So I didn't know what I could do with an English major. And for some reason, I felt like there were more practical options with art history. I don't know why I thought that. But I kind of landed on, oh, maybe I could be a curator. And I'd always loved public institutions, and that's because I was an LAUSD kid, so Los Angeles Unified School District, all the way through high school. And then I went to Berkeley for undergrad. And so I'm a product of the California public education system, and public institutions have always been my first love. And then museums were a second love, and then art was a third love. So that's how I became a curator. So I decided, and then I went to grad school. So I was getting my PhD at Northwestern, and I was working on my dissertation. And then I became really obsessed with finding a job, and I'm 99% sure I became obsessed with it, with finding a job, because that was a good and seemingly productive way or area on which to displace all of my dissertation anxiety. And so I was applying for job after. I remember applying for a job at YBCA. I applied for a job at MoMA like five times before.
New York MoMA?
Yeah, New York MoMA. Several times. Maybe it was seven times or 10 times. It was multiple times before later on I eventually got something. And it was so frustrating because I remember reading the job description. I know it's like this for a million people. You read this job description and you know you can do it. You just need someone to give you that first break, to give you that chance. And then later it happened. But, well, first of all, it happened with Guggenheim.
So I got really lucky. You finished school in Chicago and then, sorry, and then went directly to New York for your first, or did you work, did you hang out in Chicago for a bit?
No, well, I was working on my dissertation in Chicago. So I'd finished my coursework, passed my exams, and then was working on my dissertation. And I'd been interning at and doing a fellowship at the MCA of Chicago and at the Art Institute of Chicago. And then I got a job at the Guggenheim. And so I was there for a little bit, and then I started working at MoMA in New York. And that took up a big chunk of my New York years.
Wow. What was your dissertation about?
Oh, my God.
Come on.
I can't believe I was working on this. 19th century French museological history.
Wait, sir.
19th century French museological history.
That is to
And so
do
I was looking
museum?
Specifically. Yeah. But the problem is museological history.
Oh,
not music. What is that?
Musicological.
Musicology.
Museological.
Museological history.
Museological.
And I was interested in, anyway, in universalism and cosmopolitanism.
That's wild. Okay, so when did you come back to the Golden State?
It's been 3 years.
Wow, okay,
yeah.
Damn.
So when I was in New York, I thought to myself, I just want a job in California. I'm not a spiritual religious person, but I would I would pray. I would just to something. I would think, oh, please, a job in California. Because my family's in LA. And I wanted to get back to California so badly. And I didn't care, and I would think to myself, I don't care if it's San Francisco or LA, just take me back to California. Because I felt like it was, it would be too much to ask the world to take me back to LA where my family is. So I thought I would open it up a little bit and say yes for LA. And I love the Bay Area, because I went to Berkeley for undergrad. And so it worked out with SF MoMA, the timing was perfect. And then I, you know, moved to LA first, very briefly, like for a long weekend, to hang out with my family a little bit and bring my cats, who then died because of the coyotes in my parents' neighborhood.
Goddamn coyotes. I love coyotes.
Not in this context.
No.
And I shouldn't be laughing because it was really traumatic, but I'm still laughing. And then...
Laughter is one way to deal with that.
It's exactly.
It's healing.
Important.
And then the night before my first day at SF MoMA, I flew up here. And then I started work the next morning.
Oh, my
Yeah.
How's it been? That's like, cool. When you were in New York, did you tell other New York people that you were hoping to come back to California?
Mm-hmm.
And then were they like, you hippie?
I think it's everyone's dream now, isn't it, to move back to California or to move to California?
Really?
In L.A. specifically?
I feel like the New York people. I feel like New York people are always like, New York is the top of the peak.
It's true. I know people who are moving to New York from here.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because life is a little easier there.
I don't know. I think they're mm-hmm. just kind of like, they're at a point in their life and in their career where they want like the New York
mm-hmm.
boost or something. I'm not okay. sure.
Would you say?
So that's for people who've never lived in New York before.
Yes, they've never okay. lived there before.
Yeah.
I would never want to live there again.
Yeah. I would be open to it depending on the job. Yeah.
Do you feel like, though, that New York is over now?
Over for me or over generally?
Generally.
Oh, my
you're
God.
Like, you're, like, way more, because you're, like, way more tapped into, like, the global art scene and stuff and how it's all shaken out.
Depends on wherever you feel like you can get this kind of support that you need, whether that's family support. So if that takes you to Ohio, then that's where you go, or wherever your friends are. Or if you are really determined to get into the scrum of New York, you get back there too, or you go there. Yeah. It also depends on where you're at professionally and also in your personal life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a big reason why I wanted to move back to California is because of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of support that I needed and continue to need now at this point in my life.
Right on. Okay, well, that was a very holistic approach.
Or if you're Kate,
mm-hmm.
you moved to Pittsburgh for the 2020 election.
As should everyone listening to this podcast.
I remember, yeah. I remember hearing you talk about it with Astria.
You and your sweet, I don't know your mom, mm-hmm. so I'm not, maybe I shouldn't put any adjectives there, but you and your mother, mother and you,
uh-huh.
you and your mother, oh my God, what's wrong with me, have make sponges together. The Oma sponge?
Yeah. Oma means mom. Mom in Korean. And it's mostly my mom, so she can make them really fast, and that's why I say it's mostly her. Because my labor, it goes by very slowly when
they're,
I'm making them.
Are they
them.
Knit or crochet?
They're crocheted.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a, what's the material?
The material is sparkly polyester yarn.
It is, they are the
cutest. That is brought from Korea. Oh, so we're selling them now in the SF MoMA museum shop.
Right.
And I'm going to sell them too in the SF Art Book Fair because
isn't that cool?
Jackie and Aaron, they offered me a little corner of their table.
If there was one thing you could change about the art world or maybe about like the museum world,
mm-hmm.
what would it be?
Pay. Yeah.
Do you want to elaborate on that at all?
She needs to. It seems pretty fucking straightforward, especially when you look at that
spreadsheet.
That spreadsheet mm-hmm. that came out and was it Art News a while ago?
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about it. And I know, obviously, the spreadsheet demonstrates just how widespread the frustration is. But what are we supposed to do? I feel like this is yet another example of what I was just talking about, that people at the top are immovable when it comes to certain demands that are asked of them by people at the bottom. And I'm aware that I'm using hierarchical language of top and bottom. But, you know, it really does feel that way a lot of times. And because decisions like that are, of course, out of our hands. But there's no change, no matter what people, how loudly people shout for that change. And so it's very frustrating, especially in the Bay Area. And so, you know, you look at that spreadsheet, and the one frustrating thing about that spreadsheet is that people at SF MoMA are making on the higher end than people at a lot of other museums throughout the country. But we're living in San Francisco, and that salary is not enough, mm-hmm. Especially for someone like me. And it's a one-income household. So it's very, very hard.
Is there a show coming up you're really excited about? Or maybe
this is not going to end on a lighter because
we have one about genocide coming up. We're really excited about.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of research on the internment camps.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So that is not a lighter note.
The Japanese internment.
Yeah, the Japanese. Yeah. And so I'm hoping
for
that will
very
be
appropriate.
Yeah, for the California galleries. We'll see. If it's complicated because I'm trying to get together some more acquisitions and gifts in order for this show to happen. So there's multiple steps in order for the show to happen. But I'm hopeful. So we'll see. I don't know exactly when that might open, potentially late fall of next year, but we'll see what happens. I go one, you know, one lighter note would be another children's book project.
Yay!
Oh, good.
That I want to do. So there's nothing formal in the works. It's just something, an idea that I've held close to my heart for a long time. So maybe if I talk about it, well, first of all, hopefully no one will steal the idea. And oh, secondly,
don't steal her idea.
Yeah. Secondly, maybe someone will hear it and help make it happen. So I want to do a children's book on Simone Forti.
Oh, wicked.
Yes, because when she was, now I'm not remembering again all the biographical details. I've terrible short and long-term memories. I have terrible memory, period. But my recollection is, and I thought so much about this idea when I was at MoMA. So this is how, in New York, is how long I've had this idea in my mind. She was, from my recollection, a Fulbright Fellow in Rome. And she would go to the zoo every day because she was really fascinated by the movements of caged animals. Because, of course, with caged animals, there's a lot of repetitive motion. Yeah. Very sad. And that repetitive motion became the foundation for a lot of her choreographic work in the future. So I want to do a book about that. But the subtext of this book would be how evil zoos are. There needs to be a book about that if there isn't already.
Yes! I like the zoo. Love it.
Okay. And then there's another children's book I want to do that is actually even more ambitious than that. Because I think it is ambitious to do a children's book about how zoos are evil.
I mean, right? You're really working a grin. You're going upstream on that one, right?
Yeah, it feels like zoos are for children.
Yeah. And then
I mean, it's like one of their top faves, but
yeah, I mean, know,
hey,
but
we need to get
they
on
need
the
to realize here. They need to know from a very early age just how evil zoos are, because they're hell on earth. I know there's some, I don't know, some research going on conservation and blah blah blah, but those are horrible places.
It is a jail for animals.
It is.
Okay. What about,
I like zoos.
It's the zoo industrial complex.
What about animals that have like, oh god, what about animals that have like major?
I'm sure that there are a lot of good things that zoos do. I'm less aware of that only because I don't pay attention to that so much because I'm so focused on how evil zoos are in general for the majority of animals.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Are you okay?
Yeah. No, okay. I don't know. That's just, I'm just like, this might be one of the most controversial opinions that has ever been.
So. I'll be curious to hear. Not in this world, right?
I don't know, Mason.
Well, I'll be curious to see.
We got the Oakland Zoo. We got the San Francisco Zoo. Used to be the
beloved institutions.
Zoo. Well, let's have them call in and
call in. Give us a call. 419-351-6606. You can email us congratulationspinetree@gmail.com or you can tweet us @PineTreePodcast. And we'll be filtering all that information and sending it to Nancy. So fantastic.
Okay. I also want to do a kid's book on death.
So sure
that's
enough.
Other,
I mean,
that's
why
even
not?
Trickier yeah. thing. So yeah. Introducing children to death through a collaborative pair who passed away but believed that they wouldn't through their art.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This I'm not ready to talk about.
Oh, okay. This is top secret.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the nearest and dearest to my heart.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be secretive because I'm actually, in general, too sherry.
Okay.
Yeah. Which maybe you can tell through this interview.
Well, we like to end always our interviews by asking our interviewee if there's anything else you would like listeners to know.
Favorite color.
Oh, my gosh.
Favorite animal.
I need more prompts.
I don't know if a curator can stand up just for one color. I mean.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course they can. It changes all the fucking
time. No.
You know what Via Selman said about color?
Oh, yes.
She said, because, you know, she works primarily in grisaille, in black, white, and gray. She said that color is promiscuous, that it's vulgar for no reason. It's expressive. It's vulgar, and it's joyful for no reason, and it's expressive of nothing but itself.
Wicked. That's a really legit quote. I loved that show, by the way.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that
great.
Was excellent. Everybody I know who saw it loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe that Selman's is what I'll leave you with.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
That's great.
Well, thank you so much for meeting with
us.
Thanks
for inviting me.
Every time I'm
fun.
In this building, I feel like I'm more important than I am.
Oh my God, please.
And as always, Congratulations.